Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another Blaney's podcast. And this afternoon, we have with us Chris McGibbon. And welcome, Chris, to the beautiful Blaney podcast studio.
Thank you very much, Lou.
And today we'll be talking about what Chris does on a daily basis, which is to deal with issues of fraud, and in particular, his area dealing with Fidelity Recovery. So, Chris, before we go much further, why don't you tell us what Fidelity Recovery is and what you generally do in a day?
All right. So the focus of my practice and our Fidelity team at Blaney's is Fidelity Coverage and Fidelity Recovery. What we mean when we talk about Fidelity Insurance is primarily employee dishonesty insurance that indemnifies insureds for dishonest acts of their own employees, which costs them money, typically embezzlement.
So then, as the representative of the insurer, would you then be in a position to chase these employees to get back some of that money that they stole?
Absolutely.
And so I presume you have a number of different ways to do that. In other words, different processes that you have available to you to go after the employees, and more importantly, probably to go after their money or property.
Exactly. And we take a target-based approach. We have four classes of targets when we're looking at fidelity subrogation or fraud recovery. Okay. And so the first one, obviously, is the fraudster, who we also call the defaulter in fidelity insurance. The second one is any co-conspirators or beneficiaries who may have either participated in the fraud or benefited from the fraud, even if they didn't participate. The third is auditors. The fourth is banks and other financial institutions.
All right, so let's start with the first category of, your targets, which are the defaulters or the fraudsters. So typically, what would you do to try to recover money from these people?
Essentially, it's not like other litigation, where you just file a statement of claim and go through the normal process. No one can get insured for committing fraud. So it's not like there's a pot of insurance at the end of the rainbow. So you have to take a different approach with chasing defaulters. And what we do is we focus heavily on interlocutory remedies. So we're thinking in particular of ways to tie up property before it gets dissipated, Mareva injunctions, CPLs or certificates of pending litigation registered on real property, and other remedies which are available to plaintiffs, such as Norwich orders.
Perhaps you can tell me whether you get these orders by going to the judge without telling the debtor, or do you tell the debtor in advance before you see the judge?
You actually have an option with both Marevas and CPLs to proceed on notice or to proceed ex parte or without notice. And there are different considerations that go into the decision to proceed either way.
So do you need to have any certain fundamental facts available to you before you can get, let's say, a Mareva injunction? And maybe you can tell us what a Mareva injunction actually does.
All right. A Mareva injunction is an order that freezes all of a defendant's property, both real property, personal property, bank accounts, physical chattels, and freezes it effectively pending either trial or further order of the court.
And what do you need to have to show the judge that you would be entitled to get one of those injunctions?
Well, it's a high threshold.
Okay.
It's not an easy order to get in most kinds of civil litigation. However, in the case of fraud, it might be a little easier. Because the elements of the test are that you have a strong prima facie case, that there's a likelihood that the debtor is liable to dissipate their assets, and that the balance of convenience favors granting the order. However, in the case of fraud specifically, the person, if you have a strong prima facie case, the person has already proven themselves to be a fraudster. And the court is more likely to make the inferential jump that they are willing to commit a further fraud, effectively on the court, of dissipating their assets to put themselves beyond the reach of a judgment creditor.
Now, I know we talk about the word fraud freely, and maybe we should hone in on that and focus in on what fraud really is in terms of a legal definition. So is there just one kind of fraud, or are there different kinds of fraud?
There are many forms of fraud, and it resists one single definition.
Okay.
It's a very flexible cause of action.
So would stealing be fraud?
I think you would need the element of a false pretense.
So then when you speak about that kind of activity, can you give me a couple of examples?
Right. Well, with employee dishonesty, the typical scenarios we see with employee embezzlement, it can either be straight theft of funds. Another form of fraud is the phony vendor scam, where a employee sets up a outside vendor, a numbered company or some entity, and then induces his employer, the Fidelity insured, to issue checks or payments to that outside entity by leading the insured to believe that it's a legitimate vendor.
And in this way, that money is funneled from the employer to that fake company of which the employee no doubt is the sole owner, or his wife is the owner, or somebody close to him.
Exactly.
Okay, so then how would you go about convincing a judge? Look, what would you need to do? Would you bring in some witnesses and talk to the judge? What's the process by which you get these kind of, seems to me, pretty draconian orders?
Well, the beauty of handling both Fidelity coverage and Fidelity recovery is that when a claim is made under a Fidelity bond on the first party side, there are high standards of proof. A insurance policy is a civil contract, but in the Fidelity context, there are heightened standards of proof because effectively you're accusing someone of criminal conduct. So for an insured to submit a claim, they have to have pretty strong evidence suggesting that the employee has engaged in fraudulent conduct and that the insured has incurred a loss as a result.
So then, as you point out, the first target would be the defaulter or the fraudster, mm-hmm. and you go after him by, first of all, freezing all his assets. Mm-hmm. So how do you know that a fraudster has any assets? How would you even discover that out?
Well, there's a couple of avenues. One, obviously, is an asset investigation, and there are specialized investigators who perform those services and can try to locate assets of various kinds. Another option we use, a very flexible tool, is called a Norwich order.
Right.
And that is an order that is not sought against the defaulter, but is rather sought against the defaulter's banks or other institutions with which they do business. And the one of the uses of a Norwich order is to secure bank records or other records of the defaulter without his knowledge, which allow you to trace funds. So, for example, if a employee embezzles funds and the money ends up in his bank account, then they're used to make mortgage payments on a piece of real property. You can use those records to assert a claim for tracing remedy to follow those funds into that real property and then try to lock up the real property.
Now, you've also mentioned that there are co-conspirators oftentimes that assist a defaulter in embezzling funds or stealing funds.
Absolutely.
Okay, so how do you find out about the existence of those co-conspirators? And if you do, what can you do about it?
Well, there are a number of investigative steps that can be taken. Typically, a insurer will retain an adjuster who will investigate, interview witnesses, and try to identify co-conspirators. So that's one way that we try to identify who might have participated in the fraud. Another way is actually through the Norwich order. Again, if you find that there are payments in to an account by a fraudster, and then there are payments out to some other account, and say it matches some sort of pattern. I've had cases where the insured was sustaining a loss and payments were made to another individual that equated a proportion of the insured's loss at each interval. Like every month there would be a payment to this mystery account. We got the records for that account. Turned out it was an outside co-conspirator who was helping in the fraud.
So I guess there comes a point in time in a defaulter or fraudster's career as a fraudster that he has to figure out how to either hide the money or clean or wash the money. Do you go through that kind of process to see where he may have used different devices to try to wash it or clean it or make it disappear? And I'll tell you why I'm asking that question. I do a little bit of the kind of work that you do as well, besides being a podcast professional.
Yes.
I actually also practice law, and we were following a Ponzi scheme in which the Ponzor, in order to get rid of the money that he stole, would play poker, virtual poker, online, and intentionally lose to a co-conspirator who would then take all his money as alleged winnings. So I raise that because there are some real ingenious ways of trying to cloak and wash or redirect the money. Have you come across any kind of schemes? Not like that, but...
Not at that level of sophistication. Right. Most of the people that I come across don't operate at that level of sophistication, although some of them might like to think that they do. But it's very interesting. One of the tools that is available to the fraud recovery litigator is a doctrine of knowing receipt of money is impressed with a constructive trust. Now, I don't want to get into the details and the history of the constructive trust other than to say that when money is stolen by an employee from an employer, it's impressed with a constructive trust, which allows the employer to trace that money as far as it goes up into the hands of someone who receives it in good faith without notice that it's dirty money. However, there is a doctrine called knowing receipt, which is available to us to pursue beneficiaries of stolen money. And that doctrine essentially is that if an individual who's not involved in the direct fraud itself but receives funds after the fact in circumstances under which they should have been put on their notice that the money was stolen and they failed to ask any questions, that person can be liable for knowing receipt. So I would suggest that the poker buddy at the other end of that virtual poker tournament could be subject to being pursued on the basis of knowing receipt. If he knows that the money that's being lost intentionally is dirty money.
Right, of course, oftentimes in those kind of situations, the other party is located in Holland or in South America. So, and that's the issue of the internet. The internet is such a easy and transparent way to launder money around the world. But this is beyond the podcast, but it's an interesting topic anyway. I want to focus on your next target, which is the target of auditors. So what do you mean by auditors? Can you explain that to me?
Yeah, we're talking about accounting firms that perform audits of companies. Okay. This can be publicly traded companies. Financial institutions all have statutory audit obligations. Any entity that has an audit performed on its financial statements in order to properly state its financials.
So how does that help you in terms of tracing the fraud or finding of a fraud?
When we look at auditors themselves as a target,
yes,
we're looking at it from the perspective of auditors' negligence.
I see.
And also breach of contract, but comes under the rubric of auditors' negligence. And essentially, if we have an insured that had its financial statements audited, and the auditors failed to detect the fraud, then it is arguable that they have been negligent and they've also breached their contract of engagement because the financial statements are materially misstated. And as a result of that negligent work, the management of the company was unable to discover the fraud.
So then would you need to be a shareholder or an officer or director of that corporation to be able to sue the auditor?
Typically, the engagement is with the corporation itself,
okay.
So, at least when we handle auditors' negligence, as opposed to like a Hercules management type situation. When we're dealing with it, typically it'll come up in, I'll give the example of a credit union.
Okay.
And we've had several matters where we have acted in the name of credit unions who have pursued their auditors for breach of contract and negligence as a result of what we alleged were the auditors' failure to detect fraud and negligence which resulted in the credit union's financial statements being materially misstated.
And I know that there's been several cases recently at the appellate level and at the trial level where they have found auditors negligent exactly for missing the red flags of fraud.
Yes, and the most famous or infamous recent decision is probably the Livent and Deloitte and Touche decision that came out of the Court of Appeal in January of this year.
Right. So this is something that the courts are alert to and are familiar. And I presume the auditors are also now very careful about doing an audit to make sure that they find those red flags before they do the all clear.
Perhaps not as careful as we might hope. But I think definitely auditors are cognizant that courts, especially following Livent, in my view, are going to be holding them to a reasonably high standard of professional competence.
Well, that's an interesting angle and one that I'm sure will give you lots and lots of work in the future. Let's talk about your fourth target, which are banks. Can you tell me how this target assists you in your inquiry into fraud or finding fraud or finding where the money is?
Well, essentially, we look at the banks as a target in situations where there have been check frauds. And the reason for that is that there are specific rules which pertain to banks accepting, negotiating, and returning checks in Canada. And it's governed by a rather archaic federal statute called the Bills of Exchange Act. But essentially, there are specific rules that apply to the negotiation of checks, and where, in order to further a fraud, there's been a breakdown in the chain of negotiation of a check, then the bank may be liable. And I'm thinking, in particular, I can give you three examples. One is a forged drawer signature, signature on the front of the check. Say, for example, you have a bad bookkeeper, decides to embezzle funds, forges the authorized signatory's check on the front. That's a forged drawer signature. That's going to carry certain consequences, and a bank can be liable in those circumstances. Second example, forged endorsement. Someone steals a check. It's properly payable to A, but B steals it, forges A's endorsement onto the check, and deposits it into the depository or collecting bank. Under certain circumstances, that collecting bank can be liable to the drawer of the check, the legitimate owner, your insured. And then the third example is a material alteration of a check, which typically involves altering the payee and perhaps also the amount of the check so that it can be deposited into an account it's not supposed to be deposited into. Each of those types of frauds or forgeries carries certain consequences if the banks do not catch them. So, and I don't want to get into the all the arcane rules of the Bills of Exchange Act. It's an 1890 statute, and it's been updated in fits and starts, put it that way, over the years. But my caution to claims people and others who are dealing with check frauds is there are time limits in order to assert certain claims against banks, and some of those time limits are very tight. So if you have a question about a check, pick up the phone, give us a call, and we can probably tell you if you have a claim or not.
Well, Chris, this seems to me a very ingenious, innovative approach towards, as you point out, going after the defaulter. And I think that there's probably more remedies that we probably haven't had a chance to talk to you about in the short time that we have here. But I do want to thank you for coming to the Blaney's Podcast Studio and giving us your views. And good luck in chasing the bad guys. I'm sure you'll get a whole bunch. So if people want to get a hold of you or either email you, could you just give out your phone number and your email address so that people can contact you?
Sure. Phone number is 416-596-2899. Email cmckibbin, cmckibbin, at blaney.com.
Thank you, Chris, and we'll hear from you again soon.
Thank you. We'll be right back.